Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Good morning, Red Summer. Is that you? Oh. And good morning. Is this Red Summer and Terry Wilson? Are you on the air? No? Uh-oh. I can't hear you if you are. Good morning. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi. Is this Red?
No. This is Diesel Wampa with the Precious Drop Cash. I hope I dialed in the right number.
Oh, yeah. You're a little early.
Okay.
So you're just calling in early to listen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the interview for Precious Drop is not until 8:30.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I'm super early.
Oh, that's okay. I thought you were my other guest. No problem. So I'll talk to you in about half an hour, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Well, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a song and... I don't know. I'm not hearing Red. Hello, is this Red? Okay. All righty. So I'm going to play a song, and then I'm going to get our guest into the studio so we can talk about this wonderful film that's going to be premiering at Frameline 38, Al-Nisa, Black Muslim Women in Atlanta's Gay Mecca. Really interesting, wonderful film. So we're going to play Kim Nally. I'll put a spell on you, and we'll be right back. Oh, actually, no, I'm not going to. Actually, that's not the song I want to play. I'm going to play this one. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Well, I wish that I knew how it would feel to be free. Well, I wish that I could break all of the chains that are holding me. Well, I wish that I could say all of the things that I should say. I see them loud, well, I see them clear. So that the world could he? Oh,
I believe that's our guest. Is that Summer or Tia?
This is Tia.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. I was getting the word. It's like, oh, my goodness, where are my guests? And I was looking for a phone number. Oh, wow. So, guys.
Yeah, I'm working
so
on getting Red on the line right now.
Okay.
We're in two different places right now.
Oh, no problem. So why don't you tell us about the wonderful film that the two of you have made, Al Nisa, Black Women in Atlanta's Gay Mecca. Why don't you tell us about the story and how you came to make this great film?
Well, actually, I'm the production manager on the film. This is Red's baby. She actually got into it by her graduate class. She's getting her second master's in history preservation. And for an oral history project, she was asked to interview a very marginalized community, and she decided to look at Black Muslim women in Atlanta. And that was a feat in itself to find women that actually wanted to participate, and that would give her enough feedback and input for her to actually do some interviews. And so that's how it started. And she hates transcribing, and so she actually decided to videotape most of the women. And it went from there. And basically, the first part of the film includes the interview she did with the women, and then the second half is a thank you brunch where she invited the women over to her house to say thank you, and a conversation started from there because it was the first time that number of women had been together in community with those identities like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was your role? You said that, you know, it's her baby.
Well,
what was your role?
Well, being production manager, I make sure that people get to see it and that people know that it's there. So I handle interviews. I handle requests to bring it to campus. I field questions. Like the advocate reached out to us at one point and wanted to do an op-ed on Red Summer, and so I scheduled that. Just a lot of stuff here and there. I helped a little bit with the editing process, going over the documentary itself, watching it each time for differences and things that we weren't picking up on. So I've seen it quite a bit.
mm-hmm.
So things like that,
yeah.
The little behind-the-scenes stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your relationship with Red, have you all done this kind of work in the past? Because this is not her first film.
Yeah, this is not her first film. One of her many roles is she's also an actress, but this is her second documentary. This is actually my first film that I've ever worked on. But in my main role with Red Summer, I'm her agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working with her since 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't have a bio on you, so I can't share that with our audience.
Sorry.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
So why don't you give us some of your background? Are you a native of Atlanta, Georgia? Are you a Muslim woman as well?
No. Let's see. I am not a Muslim. I actually identify as Buddhist. And so another part of my role is making sure how the movie related to people outside of those identities and making sure that people don't limit themselves to only watching it if they are Black or Muslim or a lesbian. And I'm not a native of Atlanta, but I've been here for the last 3 years. I'm actually a native of Georgia, though. I grew up in a small town. I hold two degrees from the University of Georgia. I have a background in student affairs. And I am the woman behind the Buddha in Me management. And so I manage 6 different artists throughout Atlanta and 1 in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this film, as the film project progressed and the women shared their stories, which are, you know, quite moving because one woman in particular didn't even know there were other lesbian Muslim women. For 18 years, she was just in absolute isolation, and she was just so gosh, you just had to just reflect on, like, oh, my goodness, this is real. Like, really? You know, sitting around the table, you know, breaking
yeah.
bread with these women and talking about, you know, their shared experiences, but hers, you know, being in absolute isolation. She was the only one in that kind of situation, and it just sounded just really horrendous. And, yeah, I was wondering as, you know, as a you know, person that's connected to the actual production, what did that do for you as a non-Muslim, as a person just experiencing this story and these women sharing their stories? Because it's really it's quite brave of them to share their stories as well.
It is a phenomenal, amazing experience to just be in the presence of these women.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that in the beginning. Because I've become very close with a lot of them since the film and had the opportunity to talk to them about what it was like for them to put themselves out there and post. And for me in particular, I'm just very moved that they no longer wanted to be silent. They wanted their voices heard because they'll get asked, even in the film you'll see them talking about did they have any reservations about it. And for you to finally or be able to find a space where you feel comfortable enough where you're able to let go of that silence and put yourself vulnerable out there like that and have people, when you know that there is a risk with there being, you know, homosexuality in the Muslim faith, that someone may come after you and you're willing to put yourself on the line for that, for there to be a connection, for someone else to be moved by this, for someone else to know that they're not the only one, that's a phenomenal feat for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
Go ahead.
No. And just to see, like, what it was like for them for so long, for them to think that they're the only one,
mm-hmm.
it's just, it has to be a very constricting and, you know, I don't know, like, it's so hard to put into words sometimes, like, how I feel about it. It brings me to Audre Lorde's essay, The Transformation of Silence into Power and Action, thinking about what happens if our voice is never heard, you know?
Yeah, the transformation of our voices. Give us the name again, The Transformation of Our Voices.
Of silence into power and action.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And I just wonder if Red had not, you know, facilitated the transformation of these voices so that the silence could be broken. Because this is just so powerful. And I believe that Red has joined us. Is that you in the studio?
It is.
Ah, you must have heard us talking about you. yeah, Red Sommer is the director of Al-Nisa. So, Red, why don't you talk to us about the title, Al-Nisa, the woman, which is a chapter in the Quran. And this wonderful project that Atiya has been telling us about.
Well, absolutely. When I was old enough to read the Quran on my own, you know, when you're a child, you're guided through, you know, spiritual books so much. And when I was old enough to read it on my own, I was so excited, and I went immediately to Al-Nisa because I was going to be enlightened about women and womanhood and what it meant to be a Muslim woman. And I was, I'll say, a little disappointed because there were no stories of women. You know, there were no stories for women. It was really like how to deal with the possession of a woman, if I can, you know, just say it so bluntly. And I always knew that I was going to switch that focus a little bit. You know, that I wanted to have my own voice, that women in Islam should have the opportunity to speak for themselves. And a few times in different aspects that that title, you know, I wanted to use it, and it just felt like, okay, not yet, it's not time yet. And this time, it definitely was fitting. It was a valid and an important time to make that connection for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You in the film, particularly, I believe at the dinner, but I'm not sure. The thank you dinner. You talk about, you know, sort of, I believe that your father was the person who sort of connected you to the Islamic spaces, like, and, you know, he would take you to the masjid to pray and all that. And then when your mother and father divorced, you didn't have that kind of adult presence where, you know, so you had to find a way as a child and then later on when you became older to be able to go to the masjid. And is that, am I remembering your story correctly?
Well, my father definitely was the one who introduced Islam to my life, but I do want to give my mother credit that she did find Muslim women for me to take me. You know, she wasn't going to go. that wasn't her thing. But she did allow me the opportunity to go and to study and to find Islam. When I was 12, that's when I was really able to go, you know, with other women from the community and do that. So, yeah, I do want to make sure that, you know, that is said.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, so talk about your journey, because it was quite different from the women whom you interview, except perhaps, you had, like, I mean, the stories that come out in El Nisa are just, they're so diverse and so different, and yours is one of those different stories. I just wondered if you could talk about sort of, you know, your path, which it didn't sound as, I mean, when you say that you read El Nisa, you say, oh, no, we're going to change this story. I mean, that's like, wow. You actually have. I mean, you know, that was no idle promise to yourself, and and yet, you know, you have other women who are, you know, sitting at the table, who, gosh, were in such isolation, and you know, really, their ability to be all of themselves was really squashed, and if they weren't lesbian, it was that they were Muslim that this was squashed, not that they were lesbian, because no one knew that. And, you know, the way they were raised, the community that they were a part of. So, and then you have these other women sit at the table, says, well, you know, I've always been all of myself, you know. So, you know, you have like the two extremes, and then you have other people that's like, well, I can't say that I'm a practicing Muslim anymore. I believe in Allah, but, you know, I'm a spiritual person, you know, with quotations around that, for want of better language. I was wondering if you could talk about your journey. And then you talk about really high-profile, you know, women artists, because you're an artist and you travel quite widely, like Michelle Ngio Cello, who said that I'm a lesbian and I'm a mother. You know, and so, and how, like, wow, you know, that's really a beautiful part of the film, too. So you could talk a little bit about the diversity of stories and these wonderful women in there. And she and I were talking about how brave they are to be on camera, and they didn't leave town either. They still live there.
Right. Absolutely. I think that, well, to start on how Anissa came about, I have to say that there is a much larger community of Muslim women in Atlanta who identify as lesbian. But everyone was not able personally to be a part of the project, right? Because of the reasons that you mentioned, some women were not able to step up and stand up because of pressures from their family or perceived pressures, because they knew that although they were living this way secretly, that to say this publicly would dishonor their families or would shame them in some kind of way or really bring a serious threat to their lives. And the women who did decide to participate were the ones who were able to overcome that. I wanted to say that I was not one of those women initially.
Okay.
That I was not willing to stand up and be seen and show my face and say my name up front. When this project started, I was very much removed from it. I was, you know, an academic and I was a professional, and so I was doing this project that was away from me. And it wasn't until I started really getting into the interviews that I realized how much of a disservice that was to not be a part of the project myself, that, no, I wasn't being being professional and academic by removing my own story from the project as well. I had to confront my own fear. I had to confront my own concept of safety and family and where I fit in as well. It took a lot for all of us. And even the project going from just something that my classmates would see, because it's, you know, started off as a class project, so just something that my professor and my classmates would see, to something that would be a one-minute trailer on YouTube. Like that conversation of going from a really private, controlled setting to something that was public was a conversation that we all had to sit down and have, because, you know, like, wait, is my mama going to see this? Like, is my community back home going to have access to this? And, you know, so the women who participated were the ones who said, I'm fine with that. And I had to get to the point, relying on their strength as well, to be a woman who was willing to say, hey, I'm okay with that. You know, people are going to contact me, and Tia can attest to the fact that people contact us all the time with some really interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you can imagine, people get really, really emotionally affected by the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But we've been divinely guided in this purpose, and we've been divinely protected as well in this process. We've been having this conversation for a year now, and I, you know, am excited to say that most of the conversation has been so healing and so beautiful and so so much of a breaking open that it makes taking that risk worth it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I wanted our audience to know that we're speaking to Red Summer and Tia. Tia, what's your last name?
Williams.
Tia Williams, about Al-Nisa, Black Women, Black Muslim Women in Atlanta's Gay Mecca. And it's going to be screening at Frameline 38, the San Francisco International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Film Festival, June 19th through 29th, 2014. On Monday, June 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. Are you and others going to be joining us here in San Francisco for the screening?
I will be there.
Oh, my.
And
what about you, Tia?
So,
are you coming?
So excited.
I'm not coming.
Oh.
I'll let her have this one.
Oh, darn. So, Red, are you traveling alone or are you bringing people?
I'm traveling alone, but there's already a phenomenal community of support in San Francisco and in Oakland. And some people even said that they are traveling, you know, an hour or so, you know, or maybe more from their homes to San Francisco just to see this film. And that was just, oh, I think, you know, that kind of support and genuine and heartfelt support means so much to me and to the women who are part of this project, on the cast and crew, you know, to have that kind of support and have people, you know, reach out to us and say that, you know, I'm taking off of work. I'm driving in from, you know, from this other city because this story is important to me.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. So, as you were speaking to these women and interviewing them and also interrogating yourself around Islam and being a woman and then being a lesbian woman, a woman who loves women. Mm-hmm. So what stories, you know, really like you had to catch your breath, or what aspect of the project that might have just really sort of made you just maybe be still in that moment. And I don't know, maybe thankful or that your experience was what it was as opposed to something else. Just wondering, reflect on
that. Well, I kind of came in contact with a story like that before I did Anissa that made Anissa so important. There was an organization called Al-Fatiha. And, I haven't seen any programming for Al-Fatiha in a few years, and so it was like, oh, when I moved to Atlanta, I was expecting to be able to participate in this organization for queer Muslim people, and like I couldn't find any meetings, I couldn't find anything that was going on again, and so I was really disappointed because when I went the first time when I was visiting Atlanta and I went to one of the meetings. There was a woman there who told her story about her outing. She didn't come out to her family. She was outed to her family. And she talked about how every single day her life was threatened, literally every day, by various family members. And they would just consistently call and harass her and threaten to cleanse the family of her sin, and that as soon as her father gave them permission, that they would do so, and they were excited about it, and they would give details on what they would do and all of this kind of stuff. And I thought about her so much from that moment. I was really looking forward to coming back and meeting her and just talking to her and getting to know her, and I couldn't find her. And it was so bothersome for me and so upsetting for me that when I had an opportunity to talk to African-American women, that's why this story was so important, when I had an opportunity to talk to African-American women who were Muslim, and therefore we didn't have that type of pressure from our families, that type of social pressure and cultural pressure that women who, you know, are in other Muslim countries and, you know, and from other, forms of Islam, that they have this pressure that we don't necessarily experience in America, and that because of that, we would have to be the ones to start this dialogue. We would have to be the ones to bring the story to the forefront and be the ones to show our faces and say our names and have this presence publicly so that women who cannot say that this is me, this is my identity, this is who I am, have some way to connect to each other, have some way to, I guess, validate themselves is like such a term that I wouldn't want to use, but, you know, definitely in knowing that you have a community, knowing that you're not the only one, knowing that something isn't wrong with you because you feel this way, that we as African-American women have the ability, have the power, and even the privilege to have this conversation with each other and in public that other women don't have. And so I was already impacted by that story before I met these women. And having them stand so strongly. And, of course, it wasn't this big boldness that I kind of, you know, I kind of identify, you know, these are my superheroes, these are my, you know, my rocks. You know, a lot of us came into this really timidly, you know, like, well, wait a minute, hold on, let me think about this first, you know. But still standing, even with the apprehension, even with the fear, even with the threat, even with all of that, still being willing to tell their stories. But I think of the women that I met, there's a couple that's a part of the project, and I had never met a couple of Muslim women, like two Muslim women together in a relationship. I had never experienced that before. And so when I met them, I was totally excited to have an opportunity to sit down with them together and separate, to be in their home, you know, in a home of a lesbian Muslim couple. Like, I don't know where else I would be able to do that.
Well, we are out of time, Red and Tia. Thank you so much for joining us. Gosh, I wish we had a little bit more time to continue this conversation. It's been really lovely. Perhaps we can talk again because, you know, what the issues that are raised by your film, Alnisa, Black Women in Atlanta's Gay Mecca, which is screening at Frameline 38 on Monday, June 23rd at 7 o'clock at the Roxy Theater, are topics and issues and really thought-provoking ideas and concepts about women who are among us. We just don't know. They just can't be all of themselves. Just, you know, we could look at Muslim women as sort of the story, but what's going on with these women, these lesbian women, is not something that, you know, is not applicable to other people who might not be Muslim, but they might be the only one, you know, of their particular belief in a particular group, and they're afraid to, like, come out and share, you know, sort of who they are, because like you mentioned,
can say really quickly, it's also difficult to come out as Muslim in the queer community.
Oh, really?
If you can imagine what it's like to come into a queer space and you're in hijab, you're not necessarily welcomed all the time. And so that's something that we can start to talk about and think about as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Well, safe travels, and I look forward to meeting you when you come to town
on
the
23rd. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, no
problem. Thank
you, Tia, for promoting and doing all the things that you do to make sure that we know about this great film. All right. You will take good care.
All right.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye. We are joined in the studio by three members of the Precious Drop Performance Ensemble. We have Abigail Fritz, Executive Director. Good morning, Abigail. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. We have Laurel Fania, Artistic Director. Good morning, Laurel.
Good morning. Actually, Laurel is not dialing in this morning. This is Uzo Wangpa.
Oh, yeah, I've got you, Uzo. But I have three people. Who's the third person?
It's just the two of us today.
Oh, because I have three people in my studio, which is, so maybe one person is just listening.
I think one couldn't make it. Mohammed Lani, sorry about the confusion.
So Mohammed's not joining us either.
He won't be able to join us,
Well, no problem. So why don't we start, before I read your bios, you both start and tell us what the Precious Drop is about. I don't want to read. I mean, I could read the blurb, but I think you could say it better than I could read it.
Yeah. Well, if I may, I'll go ahead, Uzo, first. If I may talk just briefly, what's not in the bio of the project is the history of where this was inspired from. And we decided to do Precious Drop in a conversation that Mohamed Lamine Bangoura and myself were having. He had just immigrated to the United States from West Africa, and I have also traveled quite a bit in West Africa myself. And we were just talking about the contrast of art being there and here in relation to water and how drastically different and harder it is to access water while traveling there versus when you come here, it's an abundance. And most people don't think about what if my faucet didn't turn on, or what if I had to walk a long distance just to pick up the water that I wash my dishes with. So that's where this project was born from. We said, well, let's just explore that space between, because not everyone from the U.S. may travel to parts of the world where water is more difficult to access, and those people in those parts may not come here. So we birthed Precious Drop as just an exploration of considering what our relationship is with water. It's not a project that is spewing facts or, you know, debating one position on a specific water issue. It's just really considering how we interact with it and how it shows up in our lives. And so the show that is happening this weekend, you're going to see some traditional pieces that represent traditional ways of honoring water and celebrating it and rituals around it. And then we have some more contemporary pieces that kind of inquire more of that Western point of view. That's just a little bit that I'll share. I'll let Uzo say what she would like to.
Okay. Uzo?
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Well, I came to know about some of the topics that Lamine and Abigail were exploring during a previous show that was done in San Francisco in the fall of last year. And when Abigail mentioned just inquiring about that, that was actually, I believe we were driving over the Bay Bridge, and, you know, the topic of water came up. And, you know, to make a long story short, I was really excited to be able to collaborate in this manner as an artist, to explore water. And I think you've pretty much described the show in its entirety. So, yeah.
Well, let me read a little bit of the project description, because there are some aspects that we're not necessarily talked about, touched on yet. Besides the sort of idea of water, because I know what it means to turn on the faucet and nothing comes out. When I was in Zimbabwe last year in the summer, after a while, like not even a day, turned on the faucet and there was no water. And then we had to go get water, and there was no borehole, so we had to walk. Well, I didn't have to do it because we had this nice man who worked at the house, and he would take the wheelbarrow and fill it with containers, and he would walk to where he would fill the containers up. He had to do it a few times because there were a lot of us living in the compound. And then we had to be really careful with how we use the water. Like, okay, how do I wash the dishes so that I can, you know, save the water? You know, boiling things, okay, so we can use that. And then you think about, oh, do I really need to wash all these clothes, and how am I going to rinse them? And then you think about taking a shower and washing your face and just sort of being able to preserve the water, because then you've got to flush the toilet, right? And you've got to use water to do that. And then what if you're growing things?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to remember, and then you know, if you have money, you can go buy water to drink. So you have to worry about, okay, I don't have to save this and boil it for drinking water. But then what if you know, you weren't privileged to have money to be able to go to the store and buy a gallon of water for drinking and cooking, then you'd be stuck. And so, and then you come back to the United States and you could turn on the faucet and put your toothbrush under it and brush your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you all bring up in your project description the omnipotent pan-cultural water spirit, Mami Wata, and you say that you this unified tale is revealed and woven into traditional West African fable and current events that explore this intrinsic and invaluable research through place and time. And when I watched the video, it just seems like there's so many folks that are part of, you know, the performance. And so maybe you could talk about sort of, and I was reading your bio, Uzo, and I want you to pronounce your entire name for us. It's really, it looks really pretty, but I don't know how to say it.
Well, it's much easier than you would think. It's Uzamaka.
Uzamaka.
Uzamaka Wampa.
And you're coming from a sort of a scientific perspective, because you are a community health registered nurse with a strong passionate belief in the power of music and dance, and you're an international educator who facilitates educational workshops addressing health and wellness through music and movement across the United States. And you're originally from Enugu.
Yes, Enugu.
Enugu, southeastern Nigeria. And so you're educating communities on the history of Nigeria and how music and dance continues to evolve across the continents and the various techniques of Igbo dance style. I don't know that kind of dance. And you're a dance facilitator, entrepreneur, and an advocate for healing through dance. And right now you're MSN graduate student at Grand Canyon University. Talk about your Uzo Method project and how that fits into Precious Drop.
Wow, okay. I wasn't really expecting to talk about the Uzo Method project, but I will happily do it, and it definitely connects to Precious Drop. My goal in life really is about using music and movement to improve our well-being. It worked for me. It has pulled me out of anxiety and depression. Being an immigrant girl from a different country, attempting to survive and thrive in this country, which is full of richness and full of disparities, it really became a life goal mission. In the midst of trying to survive, you know, you have to work, right? So, and then you have to keep your passion alive. Otherwise, I think you would go in with the masses being sick and unhealthy, whether it's mentally, physically, and spiritually. And music and dance is something that helps me align myself. So whenever there's an opportunity to dance, especially in a meaningful way, I tend to jump on the opportunity, you know. So Precious Drop is addressing something that even I, when you were telling your story about Zimbabwe, I think you said Zimbabwe, when you were telling your story about being there and the experiences you had to go through, it brought back all kinds of memories too, right? You know, having to be the one who's conscious here about water just because it's in my blood for experiencing having to carry water in school and not having it come out of the faucet and having to bathe and clean the bodies. Now, the fables of Mami Wata was something that in boarding school, women, girls talked about. I would say girls, because we would come in at seventh grade and get out at 12th grade. And so there was a girl run in the dormitory run by little girls. Four little girls, and there were stories about Mami Wata and what Mami Wata would do, and there were stories that were related to, some of the fairy tales we hear here or through whatever our religions are,
If you do good things will come to you. If you do bad things, you'll be punished. And somehow there was this essence of Oshun that, you know, me from the Igbo culture was not, because I grew up Catholic, and that was the sort of the indoctrination I had. So we were not supposed to talk about Mamewata. But Mamewata was something that still existed in some of those fairy tales. And so when I come to this country to hear that, wow, there were actually cultures in which it wasn't banished. Some of the stories about the water spirit weren't thrown away. That, to me, was exciting. And so I think it's also significant that it's in the Bay Area, full of water, but also a lacking of water. And so to put it all together, dancing on stage at the Malonga Conclord, I think I'm pronouncing it, I hope I'm pronouncing it properly.
Conclord.
Conclord, historic space in Oakland, to be able to do this work and address some of the untold stories in my particular culture that are told openly in other cultures, addressing water, and also being able to move with live drums and move spirit, right? All of the anxiety, all of the pain, everything that I talked about earlier, to be able to realign me in this crazy world we live in. I hope that answers your wonder.
Oh, yeah, that was excellent. And Abigail, you began dancing at the young age of 3, and you based your training in hip-hop, and jazz and theater. In 2008, mm-hmm. you completed your BA in cultural studies with a concentration in dance studies from Columbia College in Chicago, and you began traveling internationally when you were 15 as well and fell in love with the convergence of global experience. So you couple your passion with dance and your love for culture and began studying the traditions of African traditional and ballet style dance in 2006 when you traveled to Ghana, West Africa. And you continue to travel to West Africa to immerse yourself in dance and culture, studying under some of Guinea and Senegal's new and elder generations of talented artists. And you are executive director of Afrique Sange. Afrique Sugi Percussion mm-hmm. and Dance, a principal dancer with Jara Dance Project, and you perform with Bufal African Dance and Drum and Shinakari Ensemble. Oh, I've seen you then. and you're also a teacher, and you teach beginner introductory dance class at City Dance Studios in San Francisco, and you're a volunteer dance teacher for youth in Bayview neighborhood, San Francisco, where the San Francisco Bayview is published. So I wanted you to talk about some of the other members of Precious Drop, you know, who we're going to see on stage, and also let our audience know about the two-day performances. Precious Drop is going to be performed at the Malanga Cascalard Center for the Arts Theater this Saturday, which is tomorrow, Saturday, mm-hmm. June 14th, and then that's a 7 p.m. performance. And then on Sunday, the 15th, there's a 2 o'clock performance, I believe.
Yes, a 2 o'clock.
Go ahead.
I would love and be honored to talk about the artists on stage, because each artist that we brought in was, I feel, so carefully chosen for so many reasons, and there's such a unique just coming together and connection that we all share. And so you've met Uzo. She is, from by way of Nigeria. We have several artists from Guinea, West Africa, including the artistic director, Mohamed Lamine Bangora. We have a few dancers and musicians. We have a musician from Senegal. We have the Chinyakare Ensemble from Zimbabwe. We have a woman representing Diversity in Motion, who is an African-American woman who has studied Afro-modern dance. And we have Today's Future Sound, which we did a big collaboration with. They're a hip-hop and beat-making like an education organization, a nonprofit, and they work with inner city youth and youth around the country, actually, teaching beat making to kids. So we did a really unique collaboration with them that was connecting the beat of the electronic music back with the beat of the drum, and they did so using water sound. And it's such a unique project. It was an incredible experience working with those kids and seeing them draw the connections back to this live instrument of the drum while also expanding their awareness of these just the water sounds and environment around them. So that's just a general thing, and I just want to also share that there is traditional Zimbabwean Shona tradition dance, Afro-modern dance, Afro-contemporary. There is a really special thing happening on stage that if people aren't aware of some of these instruments and cultures, it might not be easy to see, but for those who do study African vernacular dance, they will understand this. But basically, there's a lot of instruments that are blending. So it's a part of that unified tale that we're connecting of all of us representing many different cultures and ethnicities coming together on stage and sharing and contributing something. So what people are going to see is several different instruments from different countries, different vocalists, actually layering together and blending and fusing some dance. So there is some styles that are preserved and then some that are fused. And that has been a very interesting experience of together and that unifying. So that's a little bit of who you're going to see, what you're going to see. I wish I could list all the names, but we have over 20 artists, and they're all very, very talented, amazing. I love them all so much. And so the show on Saturday and Sunday, there is also a multimedia component just in a part of that that marriage of tradition with sort of this, like, technological aspect of our, of, like, these different contrasts coming together. So there, you're going to experience a lot of multimedia as well to supplement the what you see on stage. And we have a 7 p.m. show on Saturday. The doors open at 6 o'clock. A lot of people have purchased pre-sale tickets, but, you know, if you know you want to come to the show, I would encourage getting them online or showing up at 6 o'clock. And on Saturday, we are also going to have some community partners there. We're going to have the Bistat Baobab of Ofeling, some delicious Senegalese food and drink. And we, on Sunday, have a 2 o'clock performance, and that door, the doors open all at 1 o'clock. And following the show, we also have a after party at the Bistat Baobab in Oakland. That's from 4 to 7. And it's open to the public, and it's an opportunity for people to come, talk with the cast and crew, to ask more of these questions, continue the dialogue around water and the art.
Where is Bistat Baobab restaurant?
So, yeah, that's at, it's just around the corner from the theater. I believe it's 381 15th Street. So it's very close to the theater. It's walking distance. And because it's Sunday, parking should be pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Uzo, why don't you you come in and maybe have some other thoughts about the production and about some of the stories that that maybe you didn't grow up with because you were raised Catholic, but you have embraced, you know, as an adult. Through sort of learning more about, you know, Ifa, traditional spirituality in Nigeria, because there are lots of cultures, you know, Yoruba, Igbo, you know, a lot of cultures in Hausa and others. Those are some of the main ones, but there are a lot more. As long as you can
absolutely.
Maybe sort of, yeah, talk maybe in closing about some of these stories and some of these spirits that you're going to be raising and calling forth in this performance about water.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, yes, I was raised Catholic, and funny enough, a lot of the stories are very similar, you know. The angels and saints, to me, are similar, which is what helps me process some of these stories, are similar to some of the other spirits we hear about, and some of them may be traditional Yoruba or Condomblé religions and cultures. For me personally, I only know spirit I experience, which is manifested through dance and movement I call God. Now, you know, usually, you know, and hopefully I hope the listeners are able to come and experience this with us all. But when the music plays and when the drums come on, for me, I lose myself into spirit, and I don't know what that spirit is called. Now, growing up at home, my father would tell stories about witnessing the spirit of the water. You know, it typically wouldn't have a name, but sometimes when you look into the body of water, you feel so much smaller. It's like being in the forest or like being in the mountains. And sometimes the nature takes over us. We can feel that spirit. So that was something that was never new to me, although I had to be, I had to follow this, like I said, indoctrination. Taboo, you know, like I said, to talk about some of these spirits that don't fit into the construct that we're given. And so, but one particular story was, you know, the fairy tale of the woman who's by the rock before sunrise. If you catch her, you catch her. And she's there in solitude and in peace and calmness. And now I would hear my father say that she would brush her hair. I soon asked him after, as an adult, was that really true? Or was that another tale that you told us? Because he said she would brush her hair, but her hair was matted up. And so there was also a consciousness that this, like a feminine entity that was sitting by the rock, by the water, in calmness, almost like the one who owns this space in this time, in flesh. I never understood about you know, why some of the stories that he told us, because he still hasn't confirmed that that was something he saw visually in the flesh. But I believe it was part of the tale of keeping it alive, and understanding that there are stories that exist beyond what we're what taught us in school or what we learned in church.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. This is going to be quite an experience, Precious Drop. Yeah, it's going to be really wonderful. So I'll let our audience know again that we're speaking to Abigail and Uzo, who are a part of the performance Precious Drop at the Malanga Center in Oakland on Saturday and Sunday. Saturday's performance is at 7, and Sunday is at 2. And then one thing about having it as a matinee, afterwards you get a chance to go to the party at Bisatayaba, which is right around the corner. You could just follow the procession if you didn't get the the details.
Exactly.
So 1428 Alice Street in Oakland, near downtown. And how do people get tickets?
Sure. So we are selling on brown paper tickets, and you simply can search Precious Drop. And you can also go directly to http://preciousdrop.brownpapertickets.com. You can also visit our website for more information. It's afriqsugi.com, afriqsugue.com. And people can also buy at the door if that's easier.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Well, thank you both so much for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you all on Saturday evening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sounds like it's going to be not to be missed. Thank you very much. You take care.
Thank you, Wanda.
All right.
Yeah, thanks again. Bye.
Bye. So we're going to be talking about water some more with quite a few guests, but we're going to start with, let me get my notes here, we're going to be talking about Thirsty for Justice, the struggle for the human right to water, and that is really cool. It's a part of the Berkeley Juneteenth this weekend. It's going to be really exciting, and we have on the air, we have the co-producer and co-director of the new documentary, Reverend Lindy Ramsden. Good morning, Lindy. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm fine. Thank you.
Excellent. And I believe we have Colin Bailey on the line. He's the executive director of the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. Good morning, Colin.
You do. Good morning.
Great, great. And I think we also have Jennifer Clary on the line. Good morning. Is that you, Jennifer?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay, Jennifer has served as the Water Policy and Legislative Analyst for Clean Water Action's California program since 2003. So welcome to all of you, and we're going to probably have some other folks joining us. Mr. Whitney Dotson said he was going to call in, and I believe Tony from the American Indian Movement is going to try to pull himself away from the commencement address where he is speaking, if possible. So why don't we start with Reverend Lindy? I really enjoyed the film. It's, wow, it's really well, it's real, what you call tight, dense, and really makes you like sit back and just count our multiple blessings that we can drink the water here in Alameda County.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the film. We were blessed to have the opportunity to work with Ian Slattery, the other co-director and co-producer of the film. We had the sense that there were really some very important stories that needed to be told and lifted up throughout California in terms of communities that don't have access to safe, affordable water, rural communities, urban communities, homeless, tribal access. And so we wanted to make sure that people had an opportunity to hear those voices, especially during a time when water is so much in the public eye, but also to tell the story of the successful kind of David versus Goliath type of campaign that it took to pass the first human right to water legislation and get it signed into law. California is the first state to have done so through the legislative process, and it was an amazing experience to be part of that organization and movement. So we're hopeful that the movie will be both entertaining, educational, and help us in the process of implementing the Human Right to Water Act, which is now California law.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, and this film is screening on Sunday at the Black Repertory Group Theater. Is that correct?
Yes, it's screening on Sunday as part of Juneteenth. Right there on Adeline, and the film starts at 1:30, and then there'll be a panel discussion following in the reception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, are any of you all who are on the air presently going to be on the panel, and then are any of the people profiled in the film going to be a part of the panel? Maybe you could tell us who the panelists are.
Sure. Colin Bailey, who's on the line, Executive Director of the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, and Jennifer Clary with Clean Water Action are both going to be on the panel. They're both briefly in the film. And then Whitney Dotson, who is with East Bay Regional Parks as an elected board member and the person who did a lot of work in championing the successful Bruner Marsh campaign, which you can. We also will be having Joy. Hold on, looking for her last name from the Ecology Center in Berkeley. and Tony from the American Indian Movement. So there'll be a variety of folks to bring perspectives. In terms of folks who are featured in the film, you know, several of us are in the film briefly, but the core stories, the people who are in that film are not going to be there. But we'll be able to share a little bit more in terms of implementation and where we can go from here.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Maybe a little, tell our audience a little bit about you before we shift to Colin. You're a native Californian. You served as Unitarian Universalist minister since 1985, starting as a parish minister in San Jose, and recently completed a decade of service as executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry of California, based out of Sacramento. You're currently taking time for more personal ministry, providing care for a family member with Alzheimer's, during which time you were able to complete the film, Thirsty for Justice. You're also a graduate of Stanford University in Human Biology and attended seminary in Berkeley, where you earned a Master's of Divinity and honorary doctorate at Starr King School for Ministry as a part of the Graduate Theological Union. Colin Bailey is Executive Director of the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, and you're an accomplished social justice attorney. You lead and support EJCW's statewide policy agenda, local and regional programs, outreach and educational activities, and grassroots member organizations. Building upon California's historic adoption of the Human Right to Water Policy, EJCW now supports the grassroots effort to flesh out, implement, and enforce this mandate statewide. You can tell us what that means. In addition, you serve on several nonprofit boards, Sierra Club's Legal Committee for the Motherlode Region, and the Advisory Committee for a National Human Rights Advocacy Program. You're former chair of the Sacramento-based Coalition for Regional Equity, CORE, and co-founded the Capital Region Organizing Project, CROP. Nice names, CORE, CROP. the CORE reminds me of the old CORE, what Martin King was the founder of. Was that intentional?
Yeah, the Congress on Racial Equality, you bet.
Okay. and CROP and CORE helped build community-based power to advance equity and justice through the Capital Region. And then you've got some other things as legal aid attorney, and you've done a whole lot around sort of helping communities combat environmental pollution. And you have another, there's a film coming up called Walking on Gas. Wow, that sounds interesting. People can look that up on Walking on Gas, and that has to do with your work, a five-year campaign defeating a first-of-its-kind proposed underground natural gas storage facility that threatened to cause massive explosion and fire and contaminants to groundwater in a low-income community of color in South Sacramento. Wow, that's really close. Hmm, wow. And you have a really long bio. Yeah, so Colin, why don't you tell us about sort of some of your work and particularly the work that impacts the community, it seems like all of your work does, around the right to clean water and the right to a safe environment, particularly around what you mentioned about the underground natural gas.
Yeah, thank you, Wanda, for having me and my colleagues. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Sure.
I wanted to be sure to thank, while I had the opportunity, both Lindy and Ian for producing the video, for directing the video, as well as the other two entities besides EJCW who played a role in producing it, and that is the Unitarian Universalist Justice Ministry as well as the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. So our thanks goes to them. EJCW's work around the state dates back actually to 1999. So this year we are celebrating our 15th year anniversary. And the work continues to get more and more complex as California faces ever more challenges to the quality, affordability, and reliability of its water. The Human Right to Water campaign, as is recounted in the film, which I'm hopeful that your listeners will be able to view, recounts the five-year campaign to get the state of California to become the first state in the nation to adopt a human right to water policy. As you mentioned in my bio, my background is as an anti-poverty attorney. I spent 7 years working in legal aid, working to address the root causes of poverty. And certainly most of those are structural in nature, having a lot to do with the ways in which communities have been developed during the era of formal racial apartheid and segregated in many ways from opportunity. And so we are struggling still to this day to undo that legacy and the many policies that reaffirm in some communities that pre-existing advantage and in other communities that pre-existing disadvantage. Water is an important lens into the structures that maintain the inequities that we see around us. And so the human right to water policy, which is embodied in Assembly Bill 685, which was sponsored by then Assembly Member Mike Ng, established after that successful campaign a policy that every human being has the right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. And as mentioned by Reverend Ramsden, that has not been done before by legislative means in this nation. So this is a first. And our organization and all the groups with whom we work are working every day to implement that at the local, regional, and state level. At the state level, what that means is state agencies that have some relevance to water policy, of which there are many, including the Department of Water Resources, the State Water Control Board, the State Department of Public Health, and others, must consider this human right to water policy when revising, adopting, or establishing policies, regulations, and importantly, grant criteria when they are relevant to the uses of water described. That, in a nutshell, is the legal and kind of sociological backdrop for the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jennifer Clary, you've served as the Water Policy and Legislative Analyst for Clean Water Access California Program since 2003. You tell us what that means. And you direct the Central Valley Program and serve on key state stakeholder committees advising state agencies on actions to monitor and protect groundwater quality and invest in water infrastructure. You're also a well-known Bay Area environmental advocate serving on the board of San Francisco Tomorrow and a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. You hold a bachelor's degree in chemistry from the University of California, Berkeley. So you're another scientist, like the Reverend. And in the film, it was just so wonderful. Just these really powerful stories that you captured in the film, Thirsty for Justice, The Struggle for Human Rights, human right to water. And I was thinking about, was it the principal or the teacher who talked about in Seville, California, about the nitrates in the water and how they had to buy water for the children because they didn't want them to drink it accidentally. So they turned off all the water fountains in the school and how much that cost. And then you have the Native American woman who talks about sort of what's going on, around the polluted waters. And, and then you have Sonia Lopez that, they show all of these rashes and all of the, just bathing in this dirty water, what that does, to the inhabitants of, I guess it's Tulare County. So I just wonder if you could talk about that because Central Valley, that's where our food is grown, right? But then the people can't drink the water there. It's like, is there a connection? What's going on?
Oh, there's a big connection. So the biggest, man-made contaminant in Central Valley groundwater is nitrate, and the main source of that nitrate is from agriculture, either through manure from dairies or from application of fertilizer to crops. And so the people who work the fields are impacted in many different ways, and one of the ways is that their wells are growing more and more contaminated. And nitrate is an acute contaminant, so it can cause blue baby syndrome, where the nitrate interferes with the baby's ability to absorb oxygen, and that can be fatal. And so so if you get above the drinking water standard, you're not worried about getting cancer in 40 years. You're worried about your children. So it's a very difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And there's another person in the film. His name is Leonardo. I think it's Leonardo. And he is in Maywood, Los Angeles County. And there are just so many contaminants. I mean, they're next to a Superfund site. There's a whole lot of stuff going on. My notes are not extensive, so I was wondering if you could maybe talk about Maywood, because that was really crazy. And then the man who was homeless in Sacramento, he's not homeless anymore. And just thinking about sort of how, when you're homeless, you know, how can you take a bath? I mean, having access to water, not just for drinking, but for sanitation. And then you think about the type of diseases that are connected to the improper disposal of waste. And I know that's a thought that people who are homeless might think about, but the people who are not homeless might not think about.
Yeah, you know, the thing you learn when you talk to people who are impacted is the different ways that they're impacted that you don't think about. So if you're in a community where you can't drink the tap water, you worry about your children all the time. So I know someone said that she puts bottled water everywhere she thinks the kids will be, so they won't be tempted to drink out of the tap. And on the other hand, we find people who are really careful about drinking water but still use contaminated water for cooking. So there's you learn lots of different stories about how people cope with not having access to water, and you realize more and more how unfair it is. Now, Maywood is in a really difficult position because they have three mutual water companies, which are essentially private, that serve water to a community of 20,000 in one square mile. So it's a very dense community, a lot of immigrants for whom English is either not a language or a second language. And they've got just a stew of contaminants in their drinking water, but none of them, I don't think any of them actually exceed a drinking water standard. So the mutual companies don't actually have to treat for them. And it actually brings to light one of the big issues and barriers to safe drinking water, and that is governance. So if people don't prioritize safe drinking water and say, well, we can do what we always did and it'll be enough, that perpetuates a problem longer than it needs to be. I think the homeless issue is particularly relevant for your listeners because it's, again, an urban issue. And I think when you think about the Bay Area, and you think, well, thank goodness we have safe water, you still have to think about the fact that not everyone has access to water. So you have the homeless, and then there's access that's been lost. So historically, you have people fishing for their livelihood in San Francisco Bay, but because the bay is contaminated with mercury and PCBs, it's unhealthy to eat fish from the bay more than once a month, unless if you're of childbearing age. And so people, as a result, people have quit accessing that really valuable source of protein, and so you lose that connection to the water. And I think that's an important thing to think about, too, and I think that it's something that I really admire about Whitney Dotson's work, that he's really working to reestablish the connection between the community and the water.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Dotson, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I want to let our audience know a little bit about you. You're a board member of the East Bay Regional Park District, and you led a successful campaign to save Bruner Marsh in Richmond. And and the marsh, I believe, now bears your name, right?
Yes, from the standpoint of the city. The park district has not changed the name as of yet because they wait for people to die before they name parks after or areas after the individual. I don't plan on dying no time soon. So, but from the city standpoint, you know, it's Dotson Marsh. And okay. I am very proud to have my family name involved. And that evolves out of some work that my father did in the 60s and some work that my sister has also did. So it's not named after me. It's named after the family and our commitment to social justice.
Yeah, why don't you talk about the North Shoreline Open Space Coalition, and you? Well, I was reading that you have 40 years in public health and many years in community natural area protection. So I was wondering if you could talk about you know, the work and this the North Shoreline
yeah.
Open Space Coalition and what, and maybe define for our audience, what is a marsh and why is it important to save the
right.
marsh? Why was it important to save the marsh in West Contra Costa County?
Well, a marsh is you know, just kind of the interface between the saltwater and freshwater marshes also, and the land and the people. And it's all, everything that we do is connected. I mean, it's water, air, sun, moon, stars, clouds, all of it is this giant, enormous ecosystem. And unless we focus on solving the problems of all of those things at the same time, we're just kind of fooling ourselves. And at the base of, you know, the whole access to water discussion, it's you can't discuss it without understanding the effects of poverty that's been perpetrated on massive amounts of citizens. Out of all of my years, I've, you know, been sensitive to impoverished people, but the level of poverty that exists now, it's the worst that I've seen in this country. I've been in third world countries, and its poverty is different. But in this country, it's really kind of something that we can't ignore in addressing, you know, problems. And most of the problems that people have around water now, low income people, is the source of it is poverty.
Would anyone else like to comment? We have a few more minutes. Reverend Robinson, you haven't been able to speak since the beginning. Do you want to comment some more on the film and the various people that you profile, and maybe talk about sort of the making of the film more?
Sure. Actually, a couple things I wanted to bring up,
yes.
just to touch back to Leonardo, who was interviewed in Maywood, because one of the things that was shocking to me was to realize that the folks in Maywood, because their water companies were mutual water companies, the voting rights to vote on what happens with regard to those water companies belongs only to landlords, to property owners. And since I think it was around 75% of the people living there are renters, they're living in, you know, using the water but don't have a vehicle through which to participate democratically in decisions that relate to that water. So some of the issues that you see in terms of the human right to water, really, as Whitney was just mentioning, you know, these are core poverty issues, their discrimination issues, their structural issues that separate people from the ability to really influence what's happening. In terms of the making of the film, we felt very blessed to have the opportunity to get to know folks all over the state and to be able to bring their stories more to life to a broader audience, because many people in California, and I would include myself in that, I'm a fourth generation Californian. I grew up in the East Bay, had access to good water. I had no idea really what was what many communities were facing. One of the other pieces that is probably worth mentioning is that the issue around affordability. Sometimes, like the story in San Gerardo, in the Salinas Valley area, they now, after much, much work and many, many years of organizing, have a well that is giving them good water after their several previous wells had been contaminated by nitrates. But their monthly water bills went from around $20 a month to around $113 a month, which is really difficult if you're living on very modest, you know, fixed income or salary. And you see in California that there are many communities where people are having difficulty making sure that they can cover their water bills. And so long term, we need to be looking at something more like a lifeline rate. You can't live without water. Water is a gift of life, and it is absolutely a human right to be able to have access to it in an affordable manner. So we need to be looking at some affordability issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Anyone else want to make some follow-up comments?
This is Colin again with the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. I would just encourage people to go ahead and follow our work and get engaged, because as you've heard from the panelists on your show this morning, this is an issue that touches upon everybody, every community. It's a racial justice issue. It's a women's issue. It is a spiritual issue. It is an issue for indigenous peoples, and the list goes on and on. We are a coalition that brings all of those groups together to create power in communities to change the status quo. And we have in the Human Right to Water policy an extraordinary opportunity to really change the way our society relates to water and change our ethic to a more humane and sustainable one. Our website for more information is ejcw.org, and you can go to the film site, which is ejcw.org/thirsty.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Any others want to give contact information so that people can stay abreast of what's going on, as well as maybe become a part of the movement?
Well, this is Reverend Lindy Ramsden again. I just wanted mm-hmm. to encourage people to reserve a free ticket to the screening on Sunday at 1:30. At the Black Repertory Group main stage on Adeline. And you can find your ticket in the Eventbrite system, and it's at Thirsty on Juneteenth.eventbrite.com.
Okay, great. And I'll post these links on the description of the show as well. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Wanda, I just want to thank you for having us on. This is an issue that doesn't always get as much attention as it should, and we really appreciate your having us here to talk about it.
Oh, well, we have to change
There's nothing
that.
More.
Nothing more important than water. I agree, Mr. Dunn.
Right.
Yeah. Is there a website for you, Mr. Dotson? I'm sure they probably can go to East Bay Regional Park.
EZparks.org,
yeah. Okay. All right, excellent. Well, I'm not going to be able to make it to the screening, the public screening, and the wonderful panel discussion, but hopefully there'll be other screenings, because the issue is not one that's being resolved. You know, actually, quite a few of the problems are still active, and it's, you know, we think about water rights in other countries, but we're right here in California, and water is definitely a pressing issue. Clean water is a real pressing issue mm-hmm. for a lot of communities, and so we need to keep the conversation going. So hopefully we'll be able to have you on again to talk more about what's,
for sure.
you know, sort of current situations and some resolutions and other areas we need to focus on.
Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Thank
you,
Linda.
Welcome. You're welcome. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye. Good morning, Jana. How are you?
Good morning.
Hi. I think this is that George?
George?
This is George. How are you? Yeah.
I'm good. I'm good. and then we have Nasser. Are you with us as well?
Yes. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Oh, that's excellent. So we are going to be talking about in our final interview about the Berklee World Music Festival, and we have two of the featured artists on, which is wonderful, Joyce Lamam Ensemble with special guest Nasser Musa. So it's going to be, I really enjoyed your CD that I picked up last night from Jana. It's just really beautiful, Dreaming the Diaspora. What a beautiful work. It's just like, oh my goodness, it's just
thank
wonderful
you.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I've never heard the violin played like that.
Well, this
yeah.
is the Arabic style of the violin playing. Yeah,
it's really fantastic. And gosh, Nasser, didn't get a chance to listen to any of your music, but I'm sure just from what I read that you're phenomenal as well. So we're going to start with having Jana just sort of give us an overview of the Berklee World Music Festival, because it's in its 11th year, and then, you know, we will, you know, talk more about your work, if that's okay.
That's great. That sounds like a good idea.
Okay, cool. So Jana, tell us about
Hi, how
what
are you
it
doing?
Needs to be our... Good. Tell us what it means to be artistic director of this wonderful World Music Festival in its 11th year. My goodness, congratulations.
Well, I was hired to do this because I'm an artist and I love to do creative things. And so the people up on Telegraph knew that and tapped me. But I never knew that I was actually had any background until I was writing a grant for the Alameda County Arts Commission. And they said, does your staff have training? And I thought, yeah, you know, high school. But I have a strong melody line, and I play the flamenco guitar a bit and the piano just and sing just by myself. So for me, this is a wonderful rebirth of getting to know good music and hearing it, and it's such a blessing. I am never cease to be amazed at the stories behind the musicians, and I am stunned, and I get very happy when I see all this music together. This year there will be 15 acts, noon to 9, continuous music, ending with George and Nasser in the grand finale, and they'll tell you all about it. So briefly, Berklee World Music Festival is Sunday, June 22nd, and it's distributed all over Telegraph, in cafes, along the sidewalk, and also in people's parks. So I like to say Telegraph Avenue at Hayes, so people know to go next to the Amoeba Music Building. So even if they don't go to the website, berkleyworldmusic.org, which I hope they do so they can hear more about these wonderful artists, just go to Telegraph Avenue at Hayes next to the Amoeba Music Building, and you'll get a map and schedule for the music crawl, which is along the sidewalk and in cafes mainly, or the People's Park concert, which is terrific this year.
So tell us about the artists, returning artists and new artists, as well as sort of where in the world these artists, their music is representative of.
Okay, that's great. Well, first of all, I heard the All Nation Singers, and they opened up the People's Park anniversary event. They are a couple of people drumming from the Interfaith Tribal House, Friendship House in Oakland, and they will bring some dancers. So in the park at 1 o'clock, they dance, and then they invite people to dance with them, drumming, singing, and dancing, just a few, but a wonderful way to open up. So we found them just by hearing them, and this is what Berklee World Music does, is we showcase local art. Then we have Afro-Funk Experience, which will also be at Juneteenth, which is local, and they'll be in People's Park. Manzo Rally, we heard about them because they are members of MALO and very important in the Chicano movement, working with Cesar Chavez, and then they were Well, the band leader is also the band leader for Mallow since 1984. So he's bringing a two-time Grammy nominee, Johnny Gunn, and they're doing Latin rock after Afro-Funk. And then we end up with Pride and Joy, which is it's incredible Motown. And I love this because this was one of the first forms that actually was for all people instead of being adapted down or different people learned from them and then did their art. So Pride and Joy is very important in the history of world music. So these are all local folk. I get them by asking musicians, who would you recommend? Who's the best? People on the street say, bring this person, or we hear them. So starting out with the festival, we've got Big Lou, the accordion princess, who at noon she starts playing Eastern European and Norteña polka. And she has a great history, so read about her on the website. She's really a funny, funny person. Then we want to showcase what's going on, so when people come to the festival, they can hear these people later on. So the Town Quartet will follow at Musical Offerings, and they play their artists in residence at Musical Offerings. You can find out about them. On the street, we have Belinda Salvage, great, fun, upbeat, Irish, Celtic, Old English minstrel group. We have Spirit of 29, who's been on Telegraph Avenue as a street artist for decades, along with Michael Maisley. So we want to showcase and show people who might not know, though I know once you hear them you will, how great it is for our communities anywhere to have live music on the street, in cafes, in your home, at parties, whenever, because we need to support these artists. So all of them together showcase some of the finest musicians here, and we also give credit and honor some of the schools that bring students together. So we have Danceversity, and the girl on the poster is Danceversity. Check out the photo image on the website. They will be part of Belly Dance Bazaar outside Cody, so this will be a real great thing with a tabla player, Tim Waller, a percussionist, Tim Fusion, other people, that Kevin Cloud, other people that people can get to know. They'll be playing there for a great show, 2:30 to 3:30 outside of Cody. So what this music crawl is, people get to know their musicians. They get to hear about them, find out about them. So we have Middle Eastern Cabaret. Tom Chandler, who is an oud player, will be bringing improv Middle Eastern trance to Rasputin's. Lisa Sangeeta Moscow designed the only sarod in the world that is electric. It also is upright. She's a very fine composition person, and she will be playing with multi-instrumentalist, and it'll be his instruments with mandolin, fiddle, accompanied with her, violin. And they'll be doing ragas and some of her original work. So we have India, Traditions from Lisa, Ancient Future. Matthew Mumford is bringing Vishal Nagar and the dynamic Shen Shen Zhang on pipa. And with his fretless guitar, it's going to be not like dueling banjos. It's going to be dueling three equally dynamic musicians. They are featured along with George and Lisa for our evening performances. New to people is Vibo Symphony. They are symphony-level artists, all incredible histories coming together. They're teachers from this school with Victor Lin, the founder, all teachers from Vibo Symphony. They can play any type of music. They're going to specialize in their favorite, which is Brazilian, I would imagine, Bossa Nova, along with Choro, but also ask them to do Serbian and others. They are so talented. This is the group that I'm picking will become more prominent and should, because oftentimes we just hear good music, and then a few years down the line, sometimes we can't afford them, which is our joke, but they do come back because they support this community effort. Now, I don't know if I mentioned all of them, but they're 15 acts, and plus our craft fair. Just to be like a kid, all I can do is, oh, my God. So what's happening again is a repeat. Some people are coming in and saying, I'd like to have this group, and I say, yeah, or I bring them. My bee mentor, because I'm a beekeeper, is going to be bringing a live beehive under plexiglass so nobody can get afraid when she sells her honey and gives free honey tastings. We have an incredible artist who's coming as a crafter, doing a repurposed booth for kids making art, the hula hoop instruction, some very good international crafts, and also this is Berserkly. This is a Berserkly World Fair. So along with it, we'll have Food Not Bombs, who we honor and appreciate because they bring food to the people. Everybody can always eat there. Along with our regular food carts of Thai and barbecue, gourmet popsicles. And so I'm really thrilled at this little pearl that comes along because people come to the festival. So it helps create this vibrant festival for the people, and we want to support the musicians so much who make this festival what it is. So that's it in a nutshell. But basically, BerkeleyWorldMusicFestival.org. Go to the website so you'll find out about it. Please like us, too, and say that you're coming because that's really fun for us to read about that. So do you have any other questions about any of the artists?
Wow, that was quite a lot.
Too fast,
George,
probably.
George and Nasser, do you have any questions, any comments? That was like, my goodness.
I'm excited. Well, everything about it and talk
yeah.
about it.
It looks like an amazing lineup. Great.
Yeah, yeah.
I know a few of these artists. Actually, I worked with them too, Matthew Montfort and H and Future. We played together for a while in the past. He's a great artist, yes.
Ancient Future is fabulous because Matthew Montfort actually invented the word world fusion.
Fusion,
and
yes.
Because of his fine work, he picks different people from different parts of the world, sort of like a one-man Berkeley World Music Festival. So we're very happy that he's going to be representing Asian fusion. And also the people, like Belinda Salvage is completely unknown. She came from England, and she's starting to work in clubs doing either metal rock Celtic or straight Celtic, and she's working with other people. So we're excited that she's going to be outside of the Berkeley hat for a couple of hours with a group. She's always so exciting. And actually all the musicians are because, you know, hearing them, online or hearing them on a CD isn't quite the same. You learn so much more for live music. And then when you carry that CD back or listen to the program, you can remember. So George has been with us playing at the People's Park stage with Freddie Clark, and he had one performance last year. And I thought, why not celebrate him again and have more people reach out to him? So basically So changes every year, and we do repeat people, or they play with other groups too. So we're happy, and we're waiting for people to
thank you.
Share with
them. Thank you for having me again. And this year, I remember when you asked me, I recommended Nasa. Nasa is a great oud player. We've been playing together for a while, and he's specialized actually in Khaliji music, which is we're going to present this year at the festival. And Khaliji, it's the Gulf region of the Middle East. Maybe Nasser can tell you more about it.
Yeah, please, Nasser, tell us about Khaliji music.
Mm-hmm. Well, Khaliji means Gulf, and this goes back to the areas of the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula countries that are bordering that region. And it expands from Kuwait to the north, and it goes down to the Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and so on, until you go down to Yemen. And all those countries, their music is kind of a fusion that developed over the years that has a lot of African, Indian, besides the Arabic influences that help shape that style. So there's not a lot of it out there, and I try because the style of the oud that I play fits that style well. So we try to represent this, and we'll be playing selections from that part of the world, original stuff that I composed within that genre and folkloric and famous songs that have made it that have crossed over to other countries in the Middle East as well.
Mm-hmm. Does this come from your ancestry being a Jordanian, a Palestinian descent? Is that where this particular kind of music comes from? And maybe you can tell our audience about the oud, the Middle Eastern lute, because I think about in North Africa, in like Senegal and Mali, they play an instrument that's like the oud, but it's not the oud. And I can't think of
the Ngoni. Ngoni or kora?
Yeah.
Or the gimri, are you thinking of the...
Yeah,
the
I'm thinking about the kora.
Yeah.
The kora is just, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful.
And you've, if I'm remembering what I read in your bio, that you performed with Yusu Ndour. Am I remembering your bio correctly?
That's right, yes. I was part of that tour with the Egyptian orchestra. It's a big orchestra that came from Egypt, and their oud player couldn't get a visa. So fortunately for me, I was able to work with those great musicians and Yusu Ndour, and we toured the United States. It was really a fun tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw you all at Zellerbach. That was awesome.
Thank you. And just going back to your question, yes, my family's from Palestine, Ankarim in Palestine. And, you know, in 1948, Palestinians moved to Jordan. So I was born in Jordan, and the style of music there isn't quite the same as the Khaliji music that we'd probably be representing. But Palestinians have, because of the lack of having a home to belong to, they ended up being all over the Middle East and all over the world, which is fortunate and unfortunate. It's fortunate in the sense you get to meet people and you get to know more about cultures. It's unfortunate that it's not out of choice. But fortunately for me, I've gotten to be exposed to more cultures and more music, and I liked how that style have developed within those countries. That is originally Bedouin simple music, and it ended up being a nice art form that is called Khaliji nowadays. And it's, like I said earlier, a fusion of many styles blended together to create that style. So it's not quite Palestinian style music, which I also play and compose in, but this is also another genre that me and George have chose to represent in the festival, because just to add variety to the great art lineup of artists that you mentioned.
We'll probably also play a couple of pieces probably from different parts of the Middle East, which is we grew up with, Lebanon or Egypt. We throw a couple of songs or a couple of pieces of music. So to show the audience and different styles of Arabic music.
Right.
Including of course, the Khaliji. But mostly we're going to concentrate on the Khaliji, the Persian Gulf music.
And this is one of the things that visitors can find out about the festival. I never even knew about Khaliji. And I was putting up a poster, and this gentleman came up and he said, "I'm Khaliji." And there's such pride. People identify with being Khaliji. And we'll find out, maybe for the first time around to anywhere, what is this music? And then George and Nasa will be explaining a pan-Arabic show saying this is Egyptian. And so I have to be there so that I can find out more. And any time you play, George, it is so stunning. Anywhere I've heard you. And Nasa, I'm looking so forward to you joining in also.
Thank you. 7 to 9
at the Village. And you can look it up. It's between Blake and Parker, south of Dwight, real close to up on Telegraph. It's a wonderful place to end your Berkeley World Music Feast on June 22nd, Sunday.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, George, Lamam, that you're of Palestinian descent as well, and you were born in Beirut, Lebanon.
Yes.
You're a solo violinist exemplifying the Arab style of instrumental improvisation and lyricism. You performed, as already mentioned by Jana, at the World Music Festival, the Palace of Legion of Honor Museum, the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco, the Fine Arts Cinema in Berkeley, and many other places. And you toured nationally with the Arabic Orchestra under the direction of Simon Shaheen.
Simon Shaheen.
Simon Shaheen. Simone Shaheem, representing the Golden Age of Arab Music, presented by in association with the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And what I wanted to also mention that you teach Middle Eastern music and Arabic singing at the dance camp in Mendocino, California, and I don't know if that's happened yet. Is that coming up?
Oh, no, it's coming up. It's from July 12th to July 19th.
Okay,
it's a really
okay.
lineup of musicians from all kinds of musicians from Middle East, including Turkey, Iran, Egypt, Azerbaijan. There is 35 staff of teachers come to this camp, including, of course, belly dance teachers, including
right.
A famous belly dancer, male dancer, which is going to be teaching, is from Germany.
Wow.
So if anybody listening, it's really a place to learn a lot about Middle Eastern music in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've also composed music scores for two film and two award-winning documentaries, in particular, Occupation 101 and
mm-hmm.
Tea on the Axis of Evil, which were showcased at the Arab Film Festival in San Francisco and other venues nationally. And music from your latest CD, Oriental/Occidental, is featured in the opening trailer for the 2012 Arab Film Festival. So why don't you
yes.
talk about, both of you, what you plan for the Berklee World Music Festival this year. Maybe talk about, you know, the more about the music that you're going to be playing, and then I wanted us to talk a little bit about, you know, your work, particularly your peace work, Nasser, that you mentioned that you're a peace activist, and you perform and you do work like that, and so I want you to sort of talk about, because right now Palestine is always topical for me. And so I just wonder if you could talk about sort of what's going on there now and sort of how art is used for social change and making things better in community.
Right. Like I said earlier, it's very unfortunate that we have to be representing our culture in such circumstance. But we really have to make the best of where the world puts us, or where we end up to be in this world. So as Palestinians, we haven't had a lot of positive representation around the world. And as the conflict that you mentioned in Palestine, Israel, you know, that's been going on for years, over the years there hasn't been sort of a positive dialogue between those two nations. And even though the situation is very unjust and people are still suffering because of that occupation, we are trying to show the aspect that we belong to a culture that is rooted hundreds of years in that land. And that culture has a lot of beauty to it, besides the negative representation that you see on CNN and what have you and in the media. So we try to reflect that aspect that Arabic music generally is very rich. Palestinian music is a great part of that, an important part of that. And at the same time, we try to extend a hand to other cultures and to other nationalities. And in my case, I played with many Jewish artists that also represented the beauty of their music and their sense of feeling that this is wrong and this is unjust, and music is just a reflection that we all can dialogue and we all can lift that the walls that have been built and all the restrictions that are being forced on our people to speak up or to represent their case, and the outcome of that is just an overall understanding that we are. Me as a Christian trying to represent my faith in the right way, or in the way that it's supposed to be represented, in which we reach out with love to all nations and even so the ones we so-called enemies, and I don't think I refer to them as such, but even if you want to think of somebody as an enemy, you reach out with love and understanding and an open arm to understand and to show that love, and in order to get some of that love back and a reflection of that love that goes starting from you, and it goes around to the next person and to the next person. And I think this is the only way to achieve peace on earth. and not depend on governments and development of weapons and so on and so forth.
Peace through music. That's the motto of Amoeba Music, and it's what brings, and it's part of the festival, bringing all these people together with the stories behind the music. So thank you, NASA, for that.
You're welcome. Thank you for giving me the honor to be a part of this great lineup. And also, it's always a pleasure to play with George, me and George Quebec, years and years playing together. George has his own compositions and original style in which he composes in, which is very unique, blending the violin and such, like you mentioned earlier, and like Dreaming the Diaspora Oriental Occidental, and that blend of style is something new to me, and I was really happy to be a part of it also, and to include my style with George. This should be fun, and I always look forward to shows in which we get to feature a certain area in the Middle East, and plus our own music or original compositions and songs.
So, George, I'm looking forward. Yes. Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead. I want you to talk about your music and the style of the music and about, you know, the connection between, you know, you and Nasser and the you know, what you all create together and what you plan to create together on the 22nd.
I met Nasser actually in the Middle Eastern camp. I don't remember even how many years. And since I met him, we've been working and coordinating work together, traveled every part of the United States, played in different festivals. And so there is actually chemistry and harmony between me and Nasser. And actually, he is on the CD of Oriental Occidental. He composed a piece for the CD, and with the dialogue between the violin and the oud, called Sahar, the piece. I don't know if you have that CD, but should give it to you. And also, right now I'm working on a new album also. When Nasser actually comes here, I'm going to take him to the studio, and we're going to, I've been working on his composition and my new album too. So what I try to do in my album is bring also the Western influence. I work with so many artists beside Nasser, which is to bring the influence of also Latin music. I just actually came back from a month and a half tour in Bolivia with the famous Bolivian musician, Eddie Navilla. He's the charango player. It was an amazing, amazing tour. 6 cities, 15 concerts. And also, he's working with me on the new album, too. So the different musicians from parts of the world, I bring their influence into the Arabic violin style. And I create a new style, which is I'm really excited of doing it and keep doing it over and over.
Mm-hmm.
For this festival, the idea was to bring different also kinds of music from the Arab world, because last year when I did the festival, I concentrated on classic Arabic music, which is amazing. And this year I decided to show the audience other part of the Arab world, and I think it's going to be, they're gonna like it because it's different.
What's so exciting about this festival is that each year is a microcosm of the whole total lineup. So this year we've got fusion, which is a blend of the Bay Area artists more coming together, and then we have real authentic music too, which is roots, like what you're doing, George. And so it's such a joy, and people say, well, why do you bring Motown? Well, that's because that's part of our history, and there is no such thing as differentiated world music because we're all one, but to be able to see the different roots and celebrate the music and the people is wonderful. Thank you again. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, George, if you could talk about sort of, you know, compositionally, how you bring together these different Arabic styles in the music. I'm thinking about Dreaming of Diaspora because that's sort of my introduction to your work. And I mentioned to you early on that I've never heard, you know, a violin played like this before. It's just so, so wonderful. And let's see, somebody have company in the background? sense. I hear some ambient sounds. I was wondering if you could talk about, is there a story that you're telling sometimes in the music? Because I was looking at some of the titles, and it seems like there might be a backstory.
Dreaming the Diaspora, especially Dreaming the Diaspora, it's being you know, in a country I didn't grow up with. So I the idea came actually when I visited Lebanon in 2004. I came up with this idea. I said, I have to make an album which is reflect my life in Middle East and in Lebanon specifically. So even the titles of the on the album, it reflects that, which is a letter from home, which is I'm really yawning to go back to my country. It's singing on it, but lyrically, musically, lyrically, you can feel like I'm really missing my country. And sand and flame will remind you of the sand in the desert. My mother's song, I dedicated that to my mother, which is she passed away in 1989. Just all reflection, reflect on my country. That's why I call it Dreaming the Diaspora. I'm dreaming in a country which is I didn't grow up with. It's not my country, but it became my country.
So, George, you're promoting the music and the culture, but isn't your type of music, Arabian violin, more intricate, like raga music, but not a different rhythm? And so we think, wow, it sounds so different. Can you tell us about the rhythm and why it's how it's different from classical American violin?
Well, the whole style of playing different. In Arabic music, we use different type of scales, which is some of the scales have quarter tones. And our music is more modal. It follows the melody, and it's really totally a different style. Even the violin, we tune the violin differently in Arabic music. Instead of G-D-A-E, we tune it to G-D. It works better with the Arabic maqams, which is scales. The whole style of the playing is really have the different style. I have students who come and study with me, even classically trained, and they want to learn that style because it's really different, and that's what makes Arabic music different than Western music and has different beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the track Zaatar and Almonds. What's that about? That's really beautiful. I like that one.
This is a drum solo, right? Yeah, it's a drum solo.
Yes.
Well, za'atar, you know, it's a very famous food we eat in the Middle East. And also almonds. So I also connected to my country. It's just a drum solo, actually, which is done by my from New York, Osama Farouk, his name. And he said he wants to give me a gift for my CD, so it was a gift from him to my CD. This is actually doesn't have violin, it's just a drum solo, which is because also a lot of belly dancers like my music, so it can be used for belly dancers to choreograph on it, and also I wanted to do something different rhythmically because to show the Arabic rhythms in the Arabic music how it's played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're going to close with the title track, Dreaming the Diaspora. Before we do, I wanted to ask Nasser if you want to talk about your creative process and your compositional style with regards to, because I don't have any of your music, I don't know if yours is rooted in story as well, or is there another type of way that, you know, is it just, you know, just celebrating the different musical styles? I mean, not styles, but different musical sounds.
Oh, really? Nasser is not there?
Yeah, he's gone. Mm. Oh, darn. Okay.
Well, I can maybe tell you about Nasser. Nasser's style is amazing. He's one, actually, of top oud players in the United States and probably in the Middle East, too. He has a unique style, and he is a very, very good composer, Nasser. He can compose a piece in half an hour.
Wow.
And he has a lot of beautiful ideas, and the audience is going to love him, And he has a beautiful, beautiful voice, too, so he's going to be singing and playing at this festival.
Is there such a thing as improvisation in Arabic music? And so will you all create anything new, like right on the spot, you know, at the concert?
Absolutely. Improvisation is a big part of Arabic music. It's like jazz, you know, we take a piece of the music or the song, and we improvise, and we'll go back to the original melody. And that's what makes Arabic music beautiful, actually, the improvisation in that style and the modulation between the scales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. And are there particular dances that go with the music? Like I know with African culture, you know, rhythms
mm-hmm.
actually have songs, and they also have movements.
Oh, yeah.
That, is it similar like that?
It's similar, absolutely.
Ah.
I mean, dancers dance on any kind of Arabic music. We do a lot of shows with belly dancers, too. Yes, I would say yes, you can dance with that music, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
And you can dance at the village, as often people do, just in front. So I bet you there'll be a few dancers there, too.
Oh, yeah. Being in Berkeley, yes. I will. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that'll be lovely. Well, I really want to thank you so much, Jana and George, for joining us, and Nasir in his absence. thank him, too, to talk about, you know, this wonderful closing finale of sounds like a great, great day and evening of music, and it's free, right?
Yes, all free, 9 hours, berkeleyworldmusic.org, and stuff those, the schedule and map at our information booth near Amoeba Music on
really
the
awesome.
Telegraph.
Yeah, and then you have another music festival. Don't you have another music festival later on in September?
Yes, we have a great opportunity because the City of Berkeley wants us to be the finale for this small event called Sundays on Telegraph. So they said, come on down and provide the music programming. So that's all we need to pay for, though we always need help on it. And they do everything else. So for the first time, Berkeley World Music Festival on Sunday, September 21st, will be on the closed street with Stephen Kent will be one of our headliners bringing a group, and we'll have Zimbabwe music on Mimbira and other things. And so that'll be really great. So you can remember these festivals. This one happens to be on the solstice, Sunday, June 22nd, and our double Saturday and Sunday event is on the equinox. So Sunday, June 22nd, come on down, and you'll get the information for the fall festival. So we're excited. This is the first time our small festival has in years become a two-day event, and it'll be the first time that we are having two events. So this time it's one day on Sunday. Come on down. We're all waiting for you.
Okay. Thank you again, and we're going to close out with Dreaming the Diaspora, this title track.
Thank you.
Hi.
Sorry, I was the radio interview from...